Welcome to Let's Talk About Obesity Care, a podcast series from Let's Go. The series is focused on thought-provoking and informative conversations to support medical providers interested in obesity prevention and treatment. I'm your host, Carrie Gordon, a pediatric nephrologist turned childhood obesity treatment physician. I am a clinical advisor to Let's Go, a childhood obesity prevention program of the Barbara Bush Children's Hospital, and a practicing specialist at Maine Medical Center's Weight and Wellness Program in lovely Portland, Maine. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Tom Mello, pediatric pulmonologist and sleep specialist at the Barbara Bush Children's Hospital in Portland, Maine. We're going to be speaking about the importance of sleep and how challenging it seems to be for our patients to get enough of it. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
You've been doing sleep medicine for years. It feels like recognition of the importance of sufficient sleep and the challenges our patients face to get it has just gotten more and more attention over the last few years.
Yeah, I would say that sleep's what I would call hot right now. And part of it, I think, is just the understanding that sleep's important for your well-being and your overall general health. And I think that's where that's coming from. And also the reality is that a lot of people in the United States or across the world don't have great sleep habits. And it affects you in many different ways. It can be tired during the day, problems with focusing, attention. If you have problems with anxiety or depression, it makes things worse. So along those lines, getting a good night's sleep, which is can help quite a bit with all these things.
Well, and I also noticed that like during the pandemic, it just seems like virtual learning and the amount of time kids were spending at home, especially in their rooms during the day, really seemed to impact, you know, their ability to kind of wind down in their room and get some good continuous sleep. Did this change your practice at all, the pandemic and kids' sleep patterns with the virtual learning?
I think what's happened is I'm seeing patients present with sleep disorders, but they really have mood disorders, anxiety or depression. And what's happened is that the mental health services we across the state and country are overwhelmed right now. So sometimes it's easier to get in and see me than a psychologist or someone to help the patient. So that's unfortunate right now. So I'm seeing a tremendous amount affecting sleep. And the things I see are insomnia related to just anxiety, nightmares, just increasing other nightmares, patients who actually had control of their anxiety, but during the pandemic, things seem to worsen. And a couple other things that I'll see is just what you said, is that I think when you hang out in your room all day and you do your homework on your bed, that's just about the worst thing you can do for sleep. You know, your bed should be only for sleeping, not to hang out, doing your homework. So some kids will live in their beds right now during the pandemic. It's a little bit better when kids are out of school right now or in school right now, but before that, it's definitely been a change the last few years.
Yeah. And unlike exercise, when sleep is divided up during the day, we don't have the same benefits like when it's continuous. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. So I think what I try and do with the kids in clinic is I try and keep what I call sleep efficiency. And what I mean by that is that I think of it along the lines of if you sleep 4 hours, you're up for 2 hours, and then you sleep for four more hours, you're not going to feel as rested as opposed to sleeping for 8 hours. So when I think of sleep efficiency, it's how much time you're in bed with how much time you're sleeping. And part of the initial process we're trying to evaluate is trying to match the time they're sleeping with the time that they're in bed to try and increase sleep efficiency. And hopefully, and the goal ultimately is to feel more rested when they do sleep.
Yeah. You know, I think it's really interesting that you brought up how it feels like you're seeing a lot of patients presenting to sleep disorder clinic with really underlying mood disorders. And I've noticed that too in the obesity clinic here in Portland, that sometimes that's really the first thing I'm addressing even before I'm really focusing on sort of food relationships, although obviously all these things are so interconnected. So how do you approach patients who are coming to you looking for medications to help their kids fall asleep? This is something I hear a lot from families, like, okay, once we get a full night's sleep, everything's going to be better. And you know, I know medications affect the quality of sleep.
Yes, I think one of the tricky parts for me a little bit is that sleep's complicated, just like you talked about. And it's not just one thing where you go out and exercise or eat a good meal. Sleep's impacted by everything else. It's impacted by social media. It's impacted by anxiety, depression. It's impacted by sleep habits. And in teenagers, I see a lot of patients with what I call delayed circadian rhythm, where they go to bed late and they get up late. And that can really impact children. So one of the things for me is that I try and do is I try and tease a lot of this out. Without question, in my practice, the patients that I see, the most common cause of insomnia is not really insomnia. It's a combination of a circadian rhythm disorder, which is means the kids go to bed at 2 o'clock in the morning on the weekends, and then they get up at 12 on in the weekends, but then they have to get up at 6 o'clock for the bus on during the week. So a lot of kids have this very variable sleep schedule. The other problem also is that when you start talking with the families, you realize there's an underlying component of anxiety or mood disorder, and sometimes you'll see the patients have anxiety, depression. They can't go to sleep, so it actually ends up increases their chance of having circadian rhythm delay because they can't go to sleep. So over time, you get a circadian delay. We've talked a little about early school start times in Maine, especially with parts of the rural part of the state. It's really hard for the schools to get the kids into school. And so it becomes difficult because the teenagers are having to get up at 5:30 or 6 to get on the bus. And I think that, which is completely understandable from the school's point of view, but it can be tough for kids if they're struggling with sleep issues. And then certainly just sleep habits, just basic sleep habits. I think in general, sleep habits are important in the sense that if you go to sleep easy, it's not a problem. You don't have to think about it. But when you're having a hard time, you really have to think about it. And that's the thing I appreciate in clinic is that parents and families don't want to think about sleep habits. They just want to give you something to kind of help them sleep at night. And that's not really a solution. I think for two reasons. One is the medications aren't particularly very good. Some of them have side effects. Now, I think there is a case for them in patients with severe depression, anxiety, things like that, where you may want to use them, but I tend to recommend them using the context of working with a psychiatrist. So I actually don't give out any medication sleep, but I try and tease things out because I find a lot of times as you tease things out, you realize it's not really a pure insomnia. There's something else going on along those lines.
Right. If you're having trouble sleeping in part because of having anxiety or depression, taking Benadryl for sleep is not really getting at the underlying problem. And meds like that can affect the quality of sleep you're getting too, correct? Not just because it makes you tired so the next day.
Yeah. So the problem, I think, with some of the antihistamines, so I'll see some patients get Atarax. Sometimes with Atarax and Benadryl, there's almost like this hangover effect. Or some kids also remember they'll have a paradoxical reaction where you become very hyper with the antihistamines. So melatonin, I think there's can be goods and bads with melatonin. The melatonin is very helpful when I have a circadian rhythm disorder. Besides light, it's thought to be potent in the ways to actually move the circadian rhythm a little bit earlier. So it can be helpful. I do find that it seems like over the years, I've had patients with ADHD. And when I worked with them, they really always feel like a little bit of melatonin before bed helps me settle. And I think that actually is real because I see it so often. And some kids really feel like it makes a difference.
Well, I'm glad you said a little bit of melatonin. I have to say, I have been shocked sometimes when patients are taking melatonin, how big the doses are.
Yes, I think the concern for melatonin for me is I'll see patients with taking 10 to 20 milligrams of melatonin and it doesn't do anything. And that's really the problem with all these medications. And so one of the things that I think about a lot is that with physicians, if you're going to use a medication, use one and use the one that the best benefit and the lowest side effect profile. The biggest thing I become concerned with is when they start escalating meds because it's not working. Because what happens is you do that over and over, what's going to happen is you're going to be either maximizing or overdosing on certain medications. Or the other problem will be that you'll start adding in other medications onto the plan. And that becomes a big issue. So it's not uncommon for me to have patients see me on 2 to 3 meds for sleep. And I realize when I'm working with them, I realize, you have a circadian rhythm, I think. You're going to bed late and getting up late. That's why you're not sleeping on time. But the other problem is you have pretty severe anxiety. You're just not quite there yet as far as management goes. I would say undertreatment of anxiety is the number one cause of difficulty sleeping at nighttime. And that's also in the literature. And the literature suggests the same thing, that anxiety is the number one cause of difficulty sleeping at nighttime.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, that there was a Canadian study looking at patients who were going to their childhood obesity clinics. This was a number of years ago, and they looked at the most common mood disorder, and actually anxiety was the top one, which doesn't surprise me because I see so much of it as well. You know, I have the good fortune to get your patient notes. And so I take a lot of information from them and I use your pointers. In fact, some of your sleep hygiene handouts. And could you talk a little bit about some of the pointers when you're saying like, okay, well, maybe medications aren't the best thing. What are some of the pointers you give and, you know, pediatricians that are listening can give to families around how to improve sleep without using sedating medications?
I think one thing I would say is to probe a little bit about what the diagnosis is. One thing I think that's important is that one of the things I try and do is what's their sleep schedule during the week, like a school week, what's the sleep schedule during the weekends? And the other thing also is that a nice trick for me sometimes is to ask, what was your sleep schedule in the summer? The reason why that's important, that gives you a sense of what their circadian rhythm is. Yeah, in the summertime, I went to bed at 2 and I got up at 12, and that's fine. Except it's not going to work during the school year. Right. And but then at school, I have to get up at 6:30. So you have to kind of work with that and try and make the kids have a similar schedule on the weekends and the weekdays. That's really important. It doesn't have to be perfect, but you need to work at it a little bit. Another thing also for me is that having a clean, cool environment at nighttime is important. I have one teenager who's incredibly messy. I have another one who's super organized. And I think what I find happens is if you're organized, cool room, you tend the suggestion is you'll sleep better. The other thing also is the bed is only for sleeping. It's not for doing your homework, chatting with friends and things like that. I like a nighttime routine before bed. If they don't have one, I really like a nighttime routine for bed. So an hour before bed, you're turning off all electronics and social media and the phone. And then you're doing whatever it is that you get, take a shower, read for a little bit, anything to kind of switch your mind to doing things. And sometimes I find that some people are amenable to these suggestions. Some patients are not amenable. But I think when you're having a hard time sleeping, you have to work. I would like to start with the basics because a lot of times little things can make a big difference. And back to the medication thing is, I think for me, if you're going to use medication, the biggest thing is the big swings. Well, I slept for 16 hours yesterday, and then I slept for 2 hours, 3 days in a row. And so one of the big things with medication you're trying to do is avoid those. You can use it to avoid those swings. Not that every medication is perfect, but trying not to actually have the big ups and downs. That's a big deal because I don't like the big swings like that. But choosing medication where it works for the most part without side effects, but also trying to avoid the big swings of sleeping, where not sleeping at all to sleeping all the time.
Yeah, you know, the sleep habits of, you know, going to bed really late and sleeping in throughout the day, like into the afternoon, also worries me with regard to how it changes our food relationships. You know, if there's an adolescent who's sleeping till 2 o'clock in the afternoon to get their full night's sleep because they're going to bed so late, you know, the things we are eating during the day, we're missing a healthy breakfast, we're, you know, missing a normal lunchtime. And then, you know, you might get a dinner with your family. But then what I find is that at least the patients I'm seeing in clinic, they tend to be doing a lot of snacking late at night, a lot of carbohydrates. Really, that's not when our body was meant to be exposed to carbohydrates, and we don't metabolize them the same way as if we're eating them during the day. And so obviously in the obesity clinic, where it's not just about sleep, it's also, you know, about sort of food relationships, social relationships. It's another motivating reason to try to shift, like you said, back to kind of a healthier schedule like you would do for school.
Yes, I think so. And I think the biggest thing that I appreciate in working with the kids in the contact clinic is that sleep is just part of a healthy lifestyle. For me, a little bit is that I'm trying to move them in the direction. So like you said, having breakfast, eating, you know, three good meals, healthy meals a day. And the other thing also is that, remember, if you don't sleep very well, what happens is you tend to go to the stuff that's not good for you, like caffeine, carbs for that quick fix, sugar, all those things get you that quick fix so that you can function. But the underlying reason is because you're sleep deprived or you didn't sleep well the night before. So I know we've talked about this before, is that this big relationship between sleep and the kids in the clinic, but I think sleep is part of the process for them and part of them taking good care of themselves and leading hopefully another healthy lifestyle in and of itself. Sleep's important. You have to think about it and And sometimes, remember, small things make a difference. So some things like just maybe not staying up till 3 a.m. on the weekend. Some you don't think about that, but now I have plenty of teenagers who will refuse to do that. Okay? But the ones who do, it really does make a difference.
Oh, it's. I have a patient example of that. I had a kiddo that I saw who was up playing video games very late at night. This is middle of the pandemic when everything was still virtual, and he was kind of sleeping through his morning virtual classes. He was up late playing video games. Then to stay awake, to you know, he was like you said, soda, sugar, and you know, he came in and we talked about his sleep. I honestly didn't think he was the type of adolescent who was going to listen to me. He didn't seem that amenable in our conversations. And then I didn't see him. He canceled a bunch of follow-up. I saw him like 6 months later, and he had had significant improvements in his BMI. And really, the one thing he had agreed to do was try to go to sleep earlier. And like you said, by going to sleep earlier, then he wasn't having as much, you know, sugar, as much soda. He was sleeping better. He had more energy to move around during the day. And it was interesting because when they're able to follow through with those things, it can make a huge difference.
I think you're right. I think because what happens is it tends to be a compensation for a compensation for a compensation. So night playing video games, you go to school and you're tired. You have problems in school because you're having a hard time focusing and hard time learning, but it's really because you're sleep deprived. To cope with that, you're drinking caffeine during the day and maybe some sugar snacks just to help you get through the day, which isn't good for your weight either. So it's like a cascading effect of things. And so trying to make a small change like that, hopefully will move you away from some of those factors. That would be my ultimate goal when I talk about sleep and the kids in the clinic.
Now, one of the things we haven't gotten into yet that we definitely have to talk about is screening for sleep apnea and sleep apnea. I think it's really challenging because the adult tools like Stop Bang aren't necessarily validated the same way in our pediatric populations. And, you know, I know there's some evidence that if we see breathing pauses, if the parents are noticing that, if adolescents have those larger neck circumferences, if there's a high Malapati score, you know, those things can be a little predictive. How do we decide which kids we should be referring to you for sleep evaluations for sleep apnea?
So I think there's two problems. Just one of them is that when I see kids in clinic, I'm examining them and looking at them, and I'm thinking, how can they not have sleep apnea? And yet the family's saying, oh, we're not snoring at all. We're doing great. And so one of my concerns for that is that if I have an index of suspicion or concern, I always do a sleep study, because what I find happens is the kids in the weight and wellness clinic, they tend to under present their symptoms, or the family tends to under describe their symptoms, which makes it harder as far as that goes. So I do think the exams are helpful. So when I'm doing that, I'm trying to look for findings on exam that might be consistent with sleep for sleep apnea. So the things I think of for me is certainly 17 inch in adults, it's not children, but 17 inch in adults is above that is a risk for sleep apnea. I always think of, look at their bite and their height and their palate to see if that's an issue. I do think the Malapati score is helpful. And the reason is because I do find the kids who have in the weight and wellness clinic who have a high Malapati score, I think for me, my thought around that one is that I tend to be cautious with them. And I tend to probably overdo sleep studies on them just for that reason. And then I talk before is I think I also concerned around the kids with metabolic syndrome. And the reason is because sleep apnea has impact on a lot of those factors. So if you're struggling with those things, I always recommend that, and I know we've talked about this before, but I tend to be more cautious with them and tend to recommend doing a sleep study for that. Because what happens is that it can sleep apnea with metabolic syndrome can impact hypertension, elevated cholesterol, elevated liver enzymes, elevated sugars. And so for patients who are struggling, I think I do a lot of testing. And also there are patients in sleep medicine who have increased risk based on their weight, but they don't necessarily have symptoms. So the ones that I always think about are the patients with Down syndrome or achondroplasia. Right, really, I have a pretty low threshold to doing sleep studies. And I think for me and the kids in the weight and wellness clinic, I have a pretty low threshold. Every now and then I will, because I just can't find anything. Their pharynx is open, they're not overweight, they're not snoring. But there are other patients I find who I tend to do a sleep study, even though I'm not getting a lot of symptoms, because of the concern there's a higher yield and a higher risk going into the procedure. So I'm much more likely to pick something up.
I do sometimes have patients whose parents say, well, even if they have sleep apnea, there's no way that we'd be able to get them, you know, to wear the devices at night for sleep. And in that situation, is it worth doing? I sometimes still refer them just because I think knowing it's a challenge, maybe people in retrospect kind of look back and they'll hear how low the oxygen levels dropped or whatever, maybe they'll change their minds. But if you have a patient in clinic, do you proceed even if you're not sure if they'll tolerate the CPAP?
Yes, I do all the time. And I think your concern is a real one in the sense that there are two steps ahead of where they need to be. I think of it, for me in the clinic, I try and think of it more like, it's important for me to see if you have sleep apnea. Sleep apnea can affect everything else. But also, I'm trying to use also as a motivating tool. And what I mean by that, if a children's has mild to moderate sleep apnea, sometimes, especially if the oxygen and the carbon dioxide look good, I'll try and hold off on CPAP and maybe check another study in a year or so. But I also tell them, well, if you get worse, it's likely you're going to need CPAP. The other thing for me is for some patients, I know we've shared a few patients over the years where it almost seems like a certain weight is associated with sleep apnea. And if they can keep under a certain weight, they tend to do better. And so I think I use that as kind of a marker for the kids to help them. It's like, well, I think you need to stay under 250 pounds. I think you'll feel better. And although you have a little sleep apnea, it's not bad. But if you gain weight, we'll have to do a study. The other thing around CPAP is that I definitely try. One of the problems is that you're right. Some kids don't tolerate it or they don't want to do it. I think the kids who use CPAP and they feel better after using it, especially on the night when they have their titration study, those are the ones, without question, I have a much more successful to them. If I'm using sleep apnea, they're not noticing or not aware of anything, and I'm seeing high blood pressure or things like that, it's hard to get someone to use a machine to treat numbers. And so this is a tricky one for me when I, over the years, trying to encourage patients to do this. I also appreciate there's some kids who I think are going to do great, and they don't do very well. And also the vice versa. So I have patients who don't do well, then they actually do well. And I always tell families, let's try this for 6 months. I try and have them do it for 6 months. And many times, sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes they use it for a few days here and there, but then they don't use it otherwise. So that's a little bit tricky as well.
I think it's pretty clear that sleep's very important. And, you know, I think of the exercise specialist down at one of the Harvard programs. When he talks about exercise, he says, if the benefits of exercise came in a pill, we'd all be on it. And I think we could say the same thing about high quality sleep. The benefits of high quality sleep came in a medication that we could prescribe. Everybody would be taking it.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too, is that we don't know why we sleep in that whole process. So we know it's certainly changes over time. But what's pretty obvious clear is the effects of poor sleep and sleep deprivation negatively affects humans. That's why I think people are starting to be aware of that now. And just like you said, with exercise, really important, sleep is the same way. So, but it's also something you have to work at. No one can exercise for you. And also sleep, especially the teenagers, they have to kind of work at this a little bit and they're not used to it. And I think they struggle with that. No, actually, this is something you have to do. The problem is that I find that a lot of patients, they aren't interested in making changes to their behavior. And that's why they want a pill. So I really want to emphasize changing behavior with sleep as opposed to medication. Also, I'm concerned with the medication a little bit is that, do I have the right diagnosis? I think a lot of my consults, I'm trying to figure out what is the diagnosis, why are they not sleeping, or things that I have to sort out. That's why I tend to focus a lot on the kids on habits and behaviors, but also trying to make a diagnosis. But habits and behaviors, they're hard. There's no question they're hard. But also I try and keep it real small. And I actually try and ask the teenagers to choose one thing they want to try. Like I'll give them three or four things they could try. What one thing do you want to try? But the reason I try one thing is sometimes one thing can make a difference. Like you said in your patient, having a relatively, not perfect, but a relatively similar schedule on the weekends and weekdays for some kids can make a huge difference. So I really focus on one thing with regards to sleep and hoping that they'll find something that they're able and willing to do.
Well, I think that's a great way for us to end the podcast. So grateful to have you to help with my patients. Sleep is very complicated and so important. Thanks for taking the time today to talk to us and for helping all my patients.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Let's Talk About Obesity Care. You can find all of our episodes on your podcast app and on our webpage, letsgo.org. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, we'd really love to hear from you. Please email us at info@letsgo.org. Let's Talk About Obesity Care is produced by Let's Go, with technical support from Maine Health Educational Services. Thanks so much for joining us.